So in the debate with Dr. Stein, I basically pointed out that within his worldview, which says that nothing exists except matter, that there's no room for laws, those things which are immaterial, much less laws of logic. Laws of logic are universal, but everything we experience is particular. It's individual. Laws of logic are abstract, but according to him, everything that exists is, you know, something that could be, in one way or another, sensed. Laws of logic are absolute, but everything in his universe, as an atheist, must be contingent. So his worldview doesn't allow for laws of logic. Of course, the problem is, when you come to a debate, the only way you can evaluate a debate is if you have laws of logic, laws of reasoning. So what I said is, you may reject my worldview, but by coming to the debate, you've already assumed my worldview, because my worldview makes sense out of laws of logic. So when we say that the Scripture is self-attesting, we are not claiming that, you know, well, it just comes down to this. Some people eat Cocoa Puffs and they enjoy them, and some people don't. So you read the Bible, you enjoy it, it's Cocoa Puffs morning for you, but for other people, it's not. It is true that the analogy of tasting is accurate. Some people don't have a taste for what's there, and they reject it. But we say that when they reject it, they reject all enlightenment. That in principle, if God would allow them to be consistent with their rebellion, they would know nothing at all. And that shows the self-authenticating, if you will, the self-authorizing nature of Scripture. Calvin says in chapter 10, section 3, all men from the rude multitude to the sophisticated philosophers have corrupted the truth of God. In chapter 13 and thereafter, he defends the biblical presentation of God as triune. I want you to get that in your notes briefly, because Calvin finds this one in the many problem throughout the history of philosophy resolved in God's oneness and manyness. In chapter 14, he talks about the work of creation. He says, God made manifest the history of creation in order that men might not conceive him as pagans falsely do, or as philosophers ephemerally do, as the mind of the universe. Again, he's stressing this creator-creature distinction. God is not simply the universe, nature. God's not simply the mind of the universe, but God created the universe. And then in chapter 15, Calvin discusses human nature, and he insists that we have to distinguish between the nature of man as created and then the nature of man as fallen. In a sense, the accusation against all pagan philosophy is that it just assumes man's unfallen. It does not take account of the ethical rebellion of man. Calvin talks about the image of God in man, that man is God's likeness, and that this grants not only his rational ability, but also his moral rectitude. When man fell into sin, he did not lose his rational ability. He lost his rectitude. So how does he use his rational ability? Unrighteously. So man is still the image of God, but he has corrupted that image by taking these broad gifts that set man over against the animals and corrupted them, misused them by his sinful rebellion. In section 7 of chapter 15, Calvin says, the philosophers, ignorant of man's fall, confuse two very diverse states of man. And then I have a number of notes in chapter 16, but we're running out of time, I realize. Chapter 16 is beautiful because it stresses the providence of God, which provides the rule and order of the universe. He says there's no such thing as fortune or chance. God is not confined by natural law either, because there is no law of nature. Calvin doesn't buy this idea of nature. what we call nature is just the manifestation of God's providence and glory in the created realm. He insists that God's providence pertains to every single detail of this world, all natural occurrences, including the choices made by men. And he frees this doctrine from the accusation that this is just stoic fate. And so get this in your notes. I know that I'm hurrying quickly. Calvin says we have a personal view of the universe. The Stoic idea of fate is that there's an impersonal logos that runs through all the natural order. And so whatever things happen, happen according to this natural law, this logos. And that's fatalistic because it's not personal. Calvin says, we don't have that view. We believe that every detail, even to the hairs of our heads, are personally controlled. So that everything that happens to us, everything that we think, all of the events of our lives are an interaction with our Creator. Now granted, people don't live that way. You probably put on your shoes this morning and didn't think a thing about that having something to do with your relationship to God, because we get accustomed. But Calvin says, God personally determined what shoes you would put on, when, how, whether you'd put your socks on first or after you put your shoes on, and everything about what you do. And then Calvin turns in Book 2 of the Institutes to deal with the knowledge of God the Redeemer in Christ. So Calvin has talked about knowing God the Creator, the natural world, and man, both before and after the fall. And then in chapter 2 and thereafter, he talks about basically the doctrines of redemption that we very naturally associate with Christianity and the preaching of the gospel. I'm just going to point out two things from this section of the Institutes. In Book 2, Chapter 2, Section 12, actually sections 12 to 25, Calvin talks about the corruption of man's understanding. He tells us specifically in sections 14 and 15 and 16 that every ability men have in the liberal arts, in the manual arts, in the sciences are derived from the Spirit of God by the common grace of God. God is so gracious that though men have been beating on the flashlight with a hammer, God enables them to still use the hammer to do something worthwhile in this world. And that is a common, if you will, universal, gracious operation of God. And so God by His, this is section 17, God by His general grace limits the corruption of nature. Well, I think I've touched on enough of the Institutes to give you some of the major philosophical distinctives. Of course, it'd be wonderful if you read the entire thing, and if you'd like exposition of it, I have a course that is 80 plus tapes on the Institutes that you can go through and read it. I really do think it's important, but I've just tried to give you a boil down of the opening parts of the Institutes so you can see Calvin, if you will, qua philosopher. Of course, we don't think that philosophy and theology are radically distinct, but he says so many things in this theology text that I want you to see how he approaches philosophy. His view of enlightenment is this: God enlightens all men through the natural order and through being His image. Men by their sin darken the light. God by the Scriptures and the work of the Holy Spirit and the redemptive mercy of His Son now enlightens men redemptively that they can understand what they would have understood had they not fallen into sin. And so I'm going to boil it down and then we'll take a break. For Calvin, philosophical enlightenment comes by the gracious work of God, and it's tied to the self-authenticating revelation of God. So philosophical enlightenment amounts to, as I put in your outline, revelation and regeneration. Of course, you have to put that brief summary in the context of all that we've been talking about, in the context of the entire Institutes. But here's one view of how men get enlightened then. God is the source of enlightenment via creation, God is all the more the source of enlightenment via redemption, so that the darkening effect that's come about through our sin and rebellion has been changed through the Holy Spirit as we are guided through the work of the Spirit and the Word of the Spirit that we find in the Scriptures. Now, in the next century, we have a man at the time of the Puritan Revolution, ironically, a man who lived through the writing of the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is itself an expression of Calvin's theology. We have a man who has a different outlook altogether, Thomas Hobbes. He doesn't believe that there is a God. He doesn't believe in the Spirit. He doesn't believe in revelation, regeneration, or any of that. And we're going to look at his materialistic philosophy after a break. And then you talk about the ignorance of the world. The world will tell you, this Hobbes guy, he's the forerunner of the Enlightenment. To which I say, not. All right, as we continue our lecture, we're now going to look at a second view of enlightenment, this from the 1600s rather than the 1500s, and we're taking as our example the infamous philosopher Thomas Hobbes, whose dates are 1588 to 1679. Hobbes was educated at Oxford. After graduation, he began to be a tutor within a well-known English family, the Cavendishes, the Cavendish family. His position with them provided him the opportunity for a great deal of reflection and thought, and he made the acquaintance of most of the leading thinkers of his day, as well as in Europe. He knew Francis Bacon. He even did translation work for Francis Bacon. He was fascinated with the mathematical certainty that we see in the scientific revolution. He was acquainted with the writings of Galileo and actually in 1636 met Galileo. And it was about this time, apparently, that it dawned on him, this was his insight, and this is the key point of his philosophy, that all changes in this world, of whatever sort, all changes, changes in thought, changes in quality, color, whatever, all changes in this world are changes in motion. They are not related to the providence of God or God's intervention in this world, God's direction, God's intelligence, and so forth, but rather everything in this world is to be accounted for in terms of changes in motion. During the Puritan Revolution, Hobbes had no sympathy with the parliamentary party. He sided with the crown, with the king, and he didn't have any religious sympathy for the Puritans, that was for sure. In fact, he wrote, cynic that he was, that the Puritans and the parliamentarians, all those things for which they were arguing were really just so many disguises for their self-interest. They used all this religious talk and constitutional talk and so forth, but that was just rhetoric to cover the fact that they were trying to get ahead themselves and to become the power in the society. So Hobbes felt that he had to patiently wait out this problem. He left England, he moved to France in 1640 with the calling of the Long Parliament. He kind of saw the writing on the wall, you could say. And as he considered civil war and the inhumanity of man to man, he said this all the more showed him the need for an all-powerful government. An all-powerful government. While he was in Paris, he wrote against Descartes. We haven't studied Descartes yet, but you need to know he was a contemporary of Descartes as well as Galileo. And in Paris, he also became a tutor to Charles Prince of Wales. It's always confusing to study this period of history because people go under different names. Charles, Prince of Wales, is also Charles II of England. What I'm saying, and this is crucial, is you have to understand that when the Puritans were put down, when the Protectorate was over, when the monarchy came back to power, the person who came to power had been educated by Hobbes. Now this is interesting. In 1651, the most famous work by Hobbes, Leviathan, was published. This is an atheistic theory of government, political government. Now, because it was atheistic, it was unacceptable to Roman Catholic France. And therefore, the royal family had to distance itself from Hobbes because of the disfavor that would come because of his anti-religious sentiment. And obviously, he was condemned by the religionists in his own country, especially those who weren't monarchists, weren't royalists. So here Hobbes writes this book that gets him in trouble with everybody. But when Charles, when the Stuart monarchy is restored in England, Charles treated Hobbes well and gave him a pension. I would argue from this that young Charles II had picked up some things from Hobbes, and though he had fallen out of social favor, nevertheless still had the affection and the following of the future king. And when we see that Hobbes promotes the complete extermination of your religious opponents in culture for the sake of the unity of the state, and then we remember that upon the restoration of the Stuart monarchy, Charles II threw all the Presbyterians out of their pulpits through the Act of Uniformity, then these connections in history don't, you know, they aren't just like passing, you know, curiosities. There's a reason why these things happen. In 1666, the House of Commons prohibited atheism in England, and this is interesting. In an English law, Hobbes is mentioned by name. Really unusual. Well, enough of his life and his setting and so forth. Let's talk about his philosophy. Hobbes agreed with the philosophers of the Middle Ages that the philosopher is to construct a unified worldview in which everything has its place, every aspect of man's experience, and each of the special sciences are united in terms of this overarching synthesis and unity. Hobbes agreed that there had to be, if you will, a single formula that accounts for all the diversity that we see in this world. Let's take a moment and ask, now, for Calvin, what was that single formula? What is the unifying feature of a Calvinistic or Reformational worldview? Okay, it's God, the Creator and Sovereign and Redeemer. God is the one who makes the world, makes man, reveals himself through it, restores man through, you know, his redemptive work, who controls all things. So God is the unifying point. But Hobbes doesn't believe in God. The universe, as envisioned by Hobbes, is one in which everything that happens can be reduced to the behavior of matter in motion. For Hobbes, the universe is matter that moves in accordance with mechanical laws. And then having explained, we haven't done it in detail, but having explained that the universe is matter in mechanical motion, Hobbes now has the great difficulty of working out a political and ethical theory that's consistent with that view of reality. Now, those of you who are smiling can see what's coming, right? Here we have this realm of facts. This is matter in motion.
rather than the creation of God providentially controlled. And Hobbes is going to have to somehow bring considerations of value, that is, ethics, politics, into line with his view of the facts.
According to him, and I quote, "The subject of philosophy, or the matter it treats of, is every body of which we can conceive any generation, or which is capable of composition and resolution. Therefore, it excludes theology." Boom! He doesn't waste any time. He goes, the subject of philosophy is body, and it's not theology. So that's out. "It excludes all such knowledge as is acquired by divine inspiration or revelation as not derived to us by reason." Okay, so Calvin's worldview is based on enlightenment by revelation. Hobbes says there is no theology, there is no inspiration, only reason.
Okay, so we have reason down here that's going to be used to understand facts which are matter in motion.
He says there's only two kinds of bodies. There's natural bodies, and then there's the body politic, or the commonwealth. So all of philosophy is divided into a discussion of natural bodies and then into political philosophy. Let's look at that first part of philosophy. Philosophy deals with natural bodies. When we derive generalizations about the nature and the behavior of natural bodies, those generalizations are called first philosophy by Hobbes. First philosophy. First philosophy had previously been deemed an account of the nature of ultimate reality. Hobbes agreed. First philosophy, what's called first philosophy, primary philosophy, should deal with ultimate reality. But for him, ultimate reality was what? Body. Bodies in motion. And so first philosophy expounds the most general properties of bodies. The only meaningful metaphysic, the only view of reality that was meaningful, he said, is the new scientific or mechanical view of the universe. Then Hobbes proceeded to offer certain definitions by which theorems could be derived. He defined causality and identity and body and those sorts of things. And as he's expounding his mechanical philosophy, his first philosophy, one of the things he notes is that all contingents, or what appear to be contingents, have necessary causes. What we think and say happens by chance, because we do not perceive the causes thereof, though they exist now, what men commonly call causal or contingent is because they don't perceive the necessary cause. Okay, so Hobbes and Calvin agree with each other, right? Calvin says, don't look upon this world as chance, fortune. Nothing happens just contingently. Hobbes says, that's right. Well, Calvin says that because what is it that controls the natural world? The personal providence of God, his wisdom and his glory. For Hobbes, what controls things in the natural world are the laws of nature and mechanics. Nothing is contingent. There is no free will in Hobbes' world because everything is determined by matter in motion. According to Hobbes, what individuates things that have properties in common is the names we give to them. The principle of individuation is the assigning of a name to the individual. So the principle of individuation comes down to the definition assigned to the name. Okay. When we study through the special sciences, the things that are happening in the world, when we study the matter in motion out there in the world, it turns out, according to Hobbes, that what we're really studying is our own physiology. I want you to stop and think why that would be. I want to know something about matter in motion out there, but how do I know anything about the world out there? Well, there must be changes in me, right? Okay, light must come into my retina. Okay, and there must be something that happens inside me. There must be matter in motion here, up here in my head, if you will, that reflects the matter in motion out there in the world. And so, what I'm really studying when I study the world is my own brain. Everything that we consider in the world out there is a projection of our physiology, or that which acts upon our physiology, our brains. And so that means if we're going to understand the world, we have to understand man. What is man? Well, you already know, man is completely material. He's body. That's it. Now, what then makes man different from the lakes and the clouds and the trees and the grass growing? What's different about man? Well, according to Hobbes, there are two sorts of motions that occur in the brain of man that set him apart from all other motions in the material universe. These are the motions that we call knowing and willing. Now, I want you to appreciate this. What Hobbes must do, he wants to say man is not just like the grass growing. Man has this unique feature. He knows and he wills. But man is only matter in motion, so he must give a mechanical explanation. He must give some kind of materialistic mechanical explanation of what it is for the human body to know something or to will something. Remember, everything that happens in this world, and man is just part of the material world, everything that happens is determined by antecedent causes. There is some event, some motion out there, you know, that causes other things, and eventually we are changed, and these antecedent causes somehow must be the way to explain our knowing and our willing. Okay, so what is it for man to know something? The way in which Hobbes explains this is by introducing the notion of a phantasm. Okay? A phantasm. Phantasms are what know motions. To appreciate what he's getting at, although I'm going to criticize it in just a second, what is man? Man is body in motion, right? What is man's brain? Man's brain is, again, matter in motion. So what we have here is motion, matter in motion, of some sort. That's the brain. What the brain knows out here in the world is motion, right? Because all you have is matter in motion. And whenever anybody gives you this worldview, we may be studying. Whenever a person's worldview reduces to saying that the knowing subject and the object that is known are really all the same kind of thing, matter in motion, then what they're saying is motion knows motion. How does motion know motion? Motion is just motion, just like the motion that's supposed to be known. So how do you get self-awareness? How do you get cogitation? How do you get knowing just out of matter in motion? Okay? We were to take a number of bricks and put them in some device that jumbles them up and throws them around continuously? Would we say that somehow the arrangement of bricks would finally come to know themselves as bricks? Matter in motion. Well, does matter in motion know matter in motion? What is knowing all about? This is the problem Hobbes has to solve. And he does it, he thinks, I don't agree, but he thinks he did it by introducing the notion of a phantasm. What is a phantasm? It is a sensation. It is the way in which certain motions that occur in the brain are experienced. That is to say, motion out there in the world, let's say the motion of the tree or the clouds or whatever, sets up other motions that finally bring about motions in my brain. But the motions in my brain are experienced as things and qualities, as white clouds. How is it that there are motions in my brain that are having experiences of qualities and things outside the brain? Well, it turns out that I have a sensation. That is, a phantasm is thrown out there on the brain. Y'all have had the experience of an afterglow image in your retina? Okay. If you haven't, then I'll give you a simple, you know, way of doing this. Tonight, before you go to bed, before you turn off the light, let's say you have a little lamp there, stare at the lamp for a few seconds. Not very long, I don't want to hurt you here. Stare at the lamp, turn off the lights, close your eyes, and you know what will happen? You'll have a phantasm of the color of the light. Sometimes even the shape and so forth, for just a few moments. That's the fading of the sensation. You all know what I'm talking about? You've had experiences like that? Well, Hobbes looked at that sort of thing and said, oh, well, that's why we experience things. The motion in our brain, there's a certain part of our brain that's kind of like the theater of phantasms. It's like an afterglow. The sensation comes in there, and then it kind of tapers off. It lasts for a little while. That, too, he thought, was a kind of motion. Well, of course, there are problems with this. Let me give you four of them. Why a motion should be experienced as a phantasm, as a sensation, hasn't been explained, has it? He's just given a name to the alleged explanation. See, the problem was, how does motion experience anything? How does motion experience other motions? He says, oh, because certain of them are phantasms. Well, but the problem is, a phantasm is still a motion, and the question is, how does motion experience motion? Moreover, why is one, this is still problem number one, why is one motion experienced as red and another motion experienced as cold? On this explanation. I mean, if it's just phantasms, why is it that I still have distinct sensations? Secondly, who is it that's supposed to be having this experience and sensation? Well, I'm matter in motion, aren't I? I'm no different than the growing grass. How does the growing grass, to use the analogy, know the white clouds? It's not just a question of how a phantasm, a motion, can be experienced as a sensation. It's now a question, what is experience at all? How can matter and motion have any kind of experience, any kind of self-awareness? So we have this weird view that one motion somehow experiences another motion. Not just is caused by another motion, but has an experience of it. Those of you who are new to philosophy, this may just be, you know, flying over your heads, and I apologize for that, but write it down and think about this. To have an experience is not a first-order motion, if you will. Okay, you can turn on the cement truck, and it can be turning. It has motion. But what is it to say that that motion has an experience? of any other kind of motion or of itself. You see, there's more to that than motion in the simple sense. This is what we call experiencing. To have an experience calls for some kind of self-awareness, some kind of consciousness, if you will. But that's the very thing that Hobbes cannot account for, consciousness. If everything's matter and motion, think about those bricks I was talking about. Are the bricks ever going to get in some kind of complicated arrangement so that they're conscious of themselves as bricks? No, because there's got to be something more to it than bricks in motion to get consciousness. Thirdly, on Hobbes' account, perception turns out to be a delusion. And why do I say that? Because Hobbes says there's nothing but matter in motion. But when I have a perception, I'm perceiving more than matter in motion, aren't I? I perceive someone wearing a blue shirt, but there is no blueness. There's just matter in motion. So it turns out that my perceptions actually mislead me as to the nature of reality. Because I think I'm sensing the world as blue, as red, as cold, as hot, but there is no cold, hot, blue, or red in the world. There's just motion and matter. Fourthly, when Hobbes tries to deal with this problem, he tells us that we can correct our deceptive perceptions by the deception of sensation, he says, can be corrected by sensation itself. And here he made a real logical blunder, forgetting what level of discussion he was at. Because what he says is true when you think of sensations separately. Okay, let me give you an example. I'm driving, let's say I'm standing on the railroad tracks looking in the distance, and I have the sensation that these parallel steel rails come together. Okay, so I have one sensation that we consider illusory. They don't really come together. Well, how do I know that it's illusory? He says by sensation. Sensation corrects that. Because I walk up to where I thought the rails meet, and I check it, and lo and behold, they don't. So one sensation corrects the other sensation. And that's all true. That is how we create it. But you see, that isn't the problem. The problem for Hobbes is not to explain how a particular sensation gets corrected. The problem is, how is any sensation a reflection of the world at all? There is a universal deception going on in our perceptions if you follow Hobbes' physiology and his view of man. But now let's ask another question. With this, I'll be done. Does Hobbes know that sense experience is deceptive as such, as a basis of empirical investigation? How did he conclude that the way we perceive things with qualities was deceptive? He do that in a good scientific way of studying matter in motion? No, it turns out that he is forced to hold that as a logical inference of his metaphysical assumption. So here he is, here's the earthy Hobbes, you know. You say, okay, Hobbes, how do you know that perception as such is deceptive? Well, he doesn't know that by studying the world. He knows that because that's what his metaphysical presupposition would entail. This is a complete speculative, logical inference from a preconceived theory. Isn't that ironic for somebody who is the forerunner of the Enlightenment? To save time, I'm going to not say a whole lot about Hobbes' psychology. He held to what we today would call an association of ideas or stream of consciousness psychology. He said phantasms tend to follow one another in the order in which we have experience. He says there is a behavioral pattern in our thoughts. And so we can find the laws of behavior, the laws of human behavior. And here's one such law. If I have a sense experience of A, and that sense experience is followed by another one, a sense experience of B, then the thought of A on another occasion will tend to be followed by the thought of B as well. Okay? So, I have an experience. Let's say every time that I have looked over here at this chair, I've had the experience of nostalgia. Now it turns out that later, when I'm in a different situation altogether, and I think about that chair, then boom, I'm also going to have a thought about nostalgia. Does it sound familiar? It wasn't very sophisticated in that day. This is what we call behavioral psychology. You see, we all have conditioned responses. So you're conditioned to have put B with A, so that when you have a thought of A, then B comes with it. But the point is, Hobbes thought there was an underlying pattern in men's thoughts, and therefore in their behavior. And why wouldn't he say that? For him, everything is matter in motion. So the behavior of man must be explained mechanistically. Why do we hold to a causal principle in the world? Why do we believe that A causes B? According to Hobbes, there is no causation that we can prove out there in the world. All there is the habit of associating one thing with another. Okay, so if you've always seen a billiard ball go across the table and hit the eight ball, I mean, every time you've seen it happen this way, then the eight ball goes across the table in a particular direction, having been struck in that way. We say the billiard ball caused the eight ball to do that. But, you know, we don't really experience any causality there. Hobbes says we just have the association of this one event, the cue ball going across the table, and then the eight ball following going across the table. We have A and we have B. And it's just habitual. So it turns out that his notion of causation is nothing more but the habit of the mind to expect B to follow from A. Event B follows event A in our experience, and I'm in the habit of expecting it now. I point that out because in a couple of days we'll be looking at David Hume, and this is precisely Hume's problem. He says you can't by your senses justify the idea that there's causation in the world. All you can say is it's a habit of thought that you have. Okay, now there's a question.
If you think A.
You don't see it coming from A. You see A and then you see B.
Okay, if you have A and then you have B.
Right.
And that's relating to one another, and based upon what you said about there being habit of associating.
Right.
Everything is matter in motion.
Right.
Is everything related to everything else?
Well, what happens is you have a phantasm of A and a phantasm of B which are linked together. Because they are close together, and phantasms, he said, he just had the right to stipulate things, you know, I guess. He said phantasms follow each other in order. So if later I'm still remembering that fading phantasm of event A, then what I'm going to do is I'm also going to have a fading phantasm of B, because they always follow each other in order. But you might want to ask yourself, is that kind of assumption about human thoughts reliable in itself? I mean, just forget our Christian critique. Do our thoughts relate to one another as like encased events, like marbles, if you will, so that you always have marble A, then marble B, and so forth? Is that true? Or is thinking more like a stream, where all sorts of things kind of get weaved together? Haven't you ever had that problem? You're trying to think about something, maybe you're trying to read, and then your mind goes off on something else. Is that because what you were reading about was in your experience followed by that? No, that isn't true at all. See, Hobbes was not giving even an accurate description of our human experience. But you're forced into artificial and contrived things when you begin with a presupposition about the nature of reality that's as wrong as Hobbes was. Yes?
Well, do you see any way of adjusting, like, now your education will break that cycle? Did he see any way of adjusting the thought processes and that we thought of A, B, wouldn't think of B?
I'm not sure that he addresses that question. For him, he's just trying to give an account of what it is to think and how we are to understand human willing. He's trying to analyze human behavior. I'm not sure that he took it to a point where he said, here's how we can adjust human behavior. Hobbes believed that he had begun with certain definitions. I said that a little while ago. And that he was just now drawing out the consequences of his definitions and explaining the nature of the world and man, man's thinking, and so forth. But somebody might ask, well, Hobbes, why should we adopt your definitions? Why should we begin with, you know, your premises? And according to him, the advantage of his definitions would be found and that the theorems derived from them enable us to have more effective control over our environment. That is to say, Hobbes did not believe in the end that you should follow his worldview because it was observationally verified. He said, if you begin with my assumptions, you will have more effective control over your environment. Today we call that pragmatism. Pragmatism says we're not claiming there's an absolute truth. All we're claiming is this is the most useful way to approach things. And so he believed that his particular doctrines provided a general framework, a first philosophy, formulas by which every combination of events, whether they are natural events or human events, could be accounted for. And that his general philosophy provided greater control over the environment. Well, it's a form of controlling the environment, even to understand that it's matter in motion, so that you can adjust accordingly to what you will expect the world around you or people around you to do, given your mechanical laws. Have I answered the problem? No, I've just moved the problem to another level. My adjusting to the world around me is just matter in motion, so maybe I'm not adjusting at all, am I? You see, in the end, Hobbes cannot account for human experience, and as we're pointing out now, he can't account for human choices. Not if he's true to his presuppositions. But I do want you to make sure you understand that Hobbes did not think that his approach gave an insight into objective reality. He said, my approach is just the consequence of the definitions that I have provided. But if you define things as I have and draw the conclusions I have, then you'll get along better in this world. And so the truths in his conclusions, he considered all conditional. Hobbes did not claim this is what reality is. He says this is what reality is if you accept my definitions. Now, the ultimate ground for accepting one set of definitions instead of another is therefore not that one gives a better account of reality than the other, but that the one who holds supreme power in the state commands you to accept one rather than the other. Now, all of you should be showing looks of horror on your faces at this point. Did you hear that properly? Hobbes said you have different ways of setting up these rational schemes for reality. He thought his was beneficial. But the ultimate ground for accepting his sets of definitions over against somebody else's is that the political power forces you to do so. Whoever has supreme power in the state commands you to accept his outlook. And you begin to see how then he might have encouraged Charles II to force people to accept his outlook so there might be uniformity in the state. It turns out that Hobbes' materialism leads directly to political tyranny. Okay, I have a few more things to say about Hobbes' view of man and especially what voluntary motions are. But the point here is you have to see this moves directly into his political theory, into his view of the Leviathan. Hobbes believed that there was a chasm between every individual mind and every other individual mind. He also believed that there was a chasm between all minds and the material reality beyond them. And so we might understand a little better why he would think, since minds are not in contact and they're not even in contact with the material world beyond, why he would think that men should not seek to reason with each other to come to agreement about objective reality, but instead they need a political sovereign to compel their agreement. Let me put it to you bluntly. If man is nothing more than matter in motion, then matter in motion doesn't reason with matter in motion to find an objective truth. All you can do is take the most powerful matter in motion and beat up the other matters in motion that won't go along with what you're saying. Now, that's blunt. That's not the more sophisticated way to explain Hobbes, but you see what I'm getting at? You can't resolve differences in a materialistic universe by appealing to an objective order that reason puts us in touch with. Because reason is just matter in motion, and there is no objective order that all minds can come in touch with. Minds aren't in touch with minds, and they aren't in touch with the world outside. Brains aren't in touch with brains. Brains aren't in touch with the world outside. All you can do then is get one person to compel other people to say the same thing and to follow it. Was there a question? Will?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did Hobbes run into trouble with his atheist views or his experience mentioned in 1660 following that? I mean, this guy was an atheist.
Yeah, his Well, he was at Oxford in the first place, but he didn't express these views until after he was, you know, long gone from that institution. And yes, his atheist views got him in a great deal of social trouble in France. And as I've already told you, eventually in England, he's even mentioned by name in a provision prohibiting atheism. So he was a controversial and unliked person, except by the king, of course, who kind of liked the political despotism that is justified by Hobbes' philosophy. No, I'm not aware that he had any civil sanction brought against him. Yes?
This view right here of how individual minds are separate from one another.
Or better, individual brains.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he one great individual mind strongest to put in mind.
Yep.
Isn't that contradictory with what you with your example of Brick and how with all the matter in motion,
yeah, I think we've already killed his philosophy because we're pointing out consciousness is impossible on his philosophy. And so everything else that we're talking about now that assumes consciousness has already, you know, been destroyed. But I'm moving to other problems. I'm saying even if you, okay, everybody should be allowed a few major mistakes in their philosophy. Here's a major mistake. your philosophy can't even account for consciousness. But let's go beyond that. I'm saying, even if you allow him that, the point is, his consciousness doesn't come to truth by means of reason. In the end, he has to call for political despotism. I thought maybe you were going to ask this question. Well, if the truth is what the despot imposes, was Hobbes' view what the despot imposed? Every once in a while you have to wonder, how do philosophers miss the obvious? Here's a man who's saying, okay, well then the truth is just what the political, you know, power enforces. But his view was not being enforced by the political power. So why should he think that his view was the truth? Well, he would fall back, though, at this point. We think that's a devastating criticism, but I think he would only be scratched by it because he'd say, hey, I'm just saying that we'd be better off if the political power enforced my view. Let's go on and talk about his view of voluntary motions. I love this. Man is matter in motion, but man makes choices. We've already had occasion to point to the incoherence or apparent incoherence of that idea. Remember I told you that according to Hobbes, he's fudging here, but according to him, some of the motions that take place in this world are motions inside my brain, motions that we call phantasms, kind of like the afterglow of an experience, a sensation that fades. According to him, these phantasms account for voluntary choices. When we experience something, when we see and hear and so forth, a motion is set up that creates motion in us so that we image the thing that's outside of us. And Hobbes says that's the beginning of voluntary motion. When we have an image, this phantasm of something outside us, that's the beginning of voluntary motion. Because when we have an image of something, there tends to be an endeavor with respect toward it. That is, we are drawn to it or somehow pushed away from it.